All right, guys, welcome to a very special show on the channel. We've had a few best ball data round tables over the course of the summer. You've also seen multiple of our finalists today on Best Ball Breakfast showing some of their best ball datable submissions. And today we are going to start to bring it to its conclusion, announcing the five finalists. They're all going to come on the show today, present the best ball research that they've been doing this summer. We've all been super impressed with everything they've done and really excited to unpack it today. And joining me to do so, along with our best ball finalists will be coming throughout the show. We got Ben, we got Nick, and Sam Hoppin. Sam Hoppin, of course, with a new gig. Congratulations, by the way, Sam, with that. I think that's new since we last talked. And of course, Ben and Nick from Fantasy Data Pros. How are you guys doing?
Thanks for having us, Pete.
Yeah, I'm ready for the what will be probably the nerdiest fantasy football content anyone will ever see.
That's right. That's right. Sam, you're no stranger to nerdy fantasy football content, so you can help us out, right?
No, of course. And thank you for the congratulations. It's been a fun month plus so far, but was bummed I couldn't participate in the Best Ball Data Bowl. Life kind of got in the way there this summer, but excited to run through all of the finalist presentations here.
Yeah, and Ben, for maybe people who haven't been following along all summer, who are just stumbling upon this video, why don't you let them know kind of what the Best Ball Data Bowl is? This is its inaugural year, so I know people have heard me talk about it, but give people the kind of overview of what's going on here.
Yeah, so the Best Ball Data Bowl was basically a data bowl that me, Fantasy Data Pros, and Pete sponsored this year just to get people interested in programming and data science and stuff like that. Fantasy Data Pros is a website where we teach people how to code with fantasy football. So basically the whole point of the competition was we put out these underdog best ball data sets from BBM 1 through 3. And we asked people to basically create like a notebook, which is basically like an article, analyzing the data sets and coming up with any sort of, conclusion they wanted to. We ended up getting about 20 submissions to Data Bowl. And today we're going to meet with five of the finalists, who made the top five.
Yeah, Nick, and I remember when we set out to do this, we were kind of curious the range of outcomes on how many people would submit. You know, it is a big undertaking because one, you have people who are already well-versed in this stuff like Sam, but then even coming up with an idea that you want to tackle can be challenging, not to mention some of the, you know, hurdles of learning Python, learning the requirements to submit here. Were you ultimately impressed with how many people got submissions together?
Yeah, I think at one point Ben and I were a little worried about how many submissions were rolling in. And then August hit and it was just like, we're going to see the wide receiver avalanche submission, but it was like an avalanche of submissions because which makes sense because I truly think that some of these people put in like a full, you know, work week into their submission. So it took a lot of time. I was really impressed with how professional a lot of these submissions were. And I think this is a strong foundation. People are talking about on Twitter about how they can't wait for next year already. I think some people are learning Python as we speak, just so they can enter next year, which is really cool to see.
Yeah, and before I get to Sam too, I just want to let people know. So the rubric that we graded on for determining these five finalists, we looked at originality, you know, how unique of a concept was this? Relevance, you know, is this something actionable you can apply in your drafts? Clarity, which is a big thing when you're dealing with a lot of code, you got to make sure it's digestible. And then the data viz and the tables and kind of the visuals, you know, being a big element. So those were kind of the rubric that we worked with here. And Sam, I know you got a chance to review a bunch of these submissions recently. As someone who has tackled projects like this, what was your overall thought on the quality of the submissions?
I mean, all extremely impressive. Just the, you could see the wide-ranging skills of, you know, people who have a lot of data science skill and can apply that to best ball, and people who know sort of the best ball landscape extremely well and coming up with a very specific idea for what they wanted to explore. I mean, it's interesting because one of them that we'll hear about, like being unique in your drafts, was actually something I wanted to research this summer and just, again, never got around to. And the way he did it was very different than how I would have approached it. So it's cool to see, again, the different ways you can approach it. I love that it was sort of an open-ended prompt of like, just come up with something, come up with a unique way to analyze best ball, and really showed the wide range of skills that people have.
Yeah, I think that's what's really cool for me too, when I was reading through, of like the way I've thought about these problems or seeing other people attack them, people approaching it in an entirely different way. And that is really the cool thing of even a similar problem, there's multiple ways to approach it. And so over the course of today's show, we are going to bring on all five of the finalists to give us kind of an elevator pitch, tell us about the project, how they tackled it, some issues they ran into, and then we'll of course ask some follow-up questions. And then, you know, we will be determining the finalists over this next week or so as we all huddle. And I do legitimately want to hear back from you guys as well in the comments, which submissions impressed you the most? Because again, we're all approaching this from different angles. I'm sure, you know, for Ben and Sam and Nick, a lot of the technical aspects are going to be paramount. You know, that's a lot of what the Fantasy Data Pros course teaches and a lot of what you guys were working with. For me, I'm like, how is this actionable? Can I articulate these thoughts in a clear way to best ball masses and the normies who aren't as steeped in this kind of stuff? And so there's all kinds of elements there. So let us know after this show in the comments who you thought, you know, really shone through from these submissions. And they're all very strong. It's why they are indeed finalists, but definitely want to get your guys' feedback as well. And to kick things off, our first finalist, he actually wasn't able to be here this week. It's Chris Wecht. He is traveling right now, but he did send in a video that we are going to play here of him describing his project. It was called Quantifying Optimal Stacking and the Effects of ADP Value. And he was looking at specific questions like, how should you think about stacking relative to ADP, and how many players are too many to stack from one team? Those are definitely questions I get a ton on best ball streams. So it was awesome to see Chris kind of quantify that, and we'll let him here describe his research.
Chris Wecht, unfortunately I couldn't be there for the show today, but Pete was nice enough to let me record a short video that where I just go through my findings from my best ball data ball submission. Just want to thank Ben, Pete, and Nick for everything they did to put this contest on. Think all the submissions were great. Really going to change the way people are drafting this for the rest of this season and into following seasons. So with that, I'll get into my submission. So what I decided to look into was what is the optimal way to stack with and put data behind it, and how ADP value affects those stack, kind of trying to find the trade-offs between correlation and getting ADP value on your picks. So the first thing I looked into was just the number of players on a stack. Looking at average regular season points, you start to see a drop off once you get more than five guys in a stack. And then for the playoffs, you see a bigger drop off in those average points as the stacks get larger as well. We saw no six-man stacks make the finals last year in BBM3. And you really start to see a drop off really around five guys in the playoffs, because you know, as you get deeper into the playoffs, you need to have more and more of an optimal team, and that's harder to do the larger your stacks are. So then I looked at how ADP value affects stack sizing. So with 3 and 4 man stacks, you're able to have a more negative overall ADP value than when you get to these larger stacks. When you get to 5 and 6 man stacks, you really had to have a positive ADP value on the stack to reach an expected 16% advance rate. So with all that being said, I'm basically trying to really focus on getting 3 and 4 man stacks. And if I'm getting an extra fifth or sixth guy, it's because I'm getting ADP value on them. Don't want to be forcing adding a fifth or sixth guy if it doesn't make sense because I'm not getting ADP value. So then I decided to look into how much the QB matters for your stack. And what I found was basically teams that had the QB basically had a higher floor. They reached the expected advance rate line at a more negative overall ADP value sooner than teams that did not have the QB. So you really want to be trying to get your QB on your team for most of your stacks. And then with that, so knowing that, I then decided, all right, well, if it matters so much for my advance rate, how much should I be reaching to get my QB? So I kind of went with the extreme here and looked at what I called big QB reaches, which are basically about a round to a round and a half, depending on where you are in the draft, based off my adjusted pick value score. And what I found was interesting, the teams that reached for their QB actually reached the expected advance rate line at a more negative overall ADP value than teams that did not reach their QB. So what that means is that reaching for the QB really didn't hurt their advance rate all that much, if at all. The caveat here is that it's a bit of a small sample size, only a about 6,000 teams reached for their QB this much in a big way. So, and obviously if you reach for your QB, it's harder to have a positive ADP value. But so in the end, I'm not going to be afraid to reach for my QB, especially if I don't think they're going to make it back to me. I would not force it if you think they definitely will make it back to you. But if you have any doubts about if your QB is going to make it back and it, you already built out a nice stack, I would be prioritizing reaching that QB and seeing if I can build up the ADP value later on. So then I decided to look into where in the draft we're building our stacks from. So first thing I looked at was how many of our stack pieces come from top 48 picks. And what I found is generally these early stacks are not great. They struggled to hit good advance rates and have high average points based off of the more top 48 picks they had. So if you had just zero or one pick from the top 48 in your stack, your ADP value and advance rate is still pretty sticky. The better ADP value you get, the better your stack will perform at advance rate. But as you get to two or three guys, it really starts to fall apart where ADP value just doesn't matter. So really, I think it's a little bit of a personal preference. If you think a stack like AJ Brown plus Jalen Hurts plus Devontae Smith is the key this year, just draft them and get them wherever. It's not going to matter if you got ADP value on those guys or not. If they were the guys you need, they're going to be the guys you needed. And if not, then they're not. So unless I'm really trying to get a specific stack, I'm not really trying to stack these early picks all that much. But if I am trying to, I'm just going to go out and get them wherever I have to put the stack together. So then I looked at later picks, so picks 120 or later, how did that stack pieces affect that? And basically found that the more late round picks you had stack actually can help your playoff performance. So teams with two or more late stack pieces averaged about two more points in the quarterfinals, three more in the semifinals, and five more in the finals. So what I think this means is that when you stack up these offenses that end up outperforming ADP, it can give you a boost in the playoffs in a unique way, especially if you're getting ADP value, the numbers get even better. So then the last thing I looked into was comparing specific stacks against each other. So I took all the stacks that were done at least 750 times in BBM3 and combined them all together. And then I compared the top 10% of teams from those buckets to the bottom 10% teams in those buckets. And so for the regular season, all but one of those stacks, the top 10% of teams had better ADP value than the bottom 10% of teams. So what that means is that when you compare stacks against each other, the ones that are getting ADP value are performing better in the regular season than if they aren't. But that kind of falls apart in the playoffs. So in the playoffs, we're at 1 week sample sizes. So things are a little bit, more can go right or wrong for you in the playoffs in a single week. But basically the top 10% and bottom 10% teams, it was about 50-50 in terms of where the bottom 10% compared to the top 10%. However, it's worth saying that the best of the best of the top 10% teams generally did have good ADP value. So maybe there is something there that, it's still good to get ADP value. But all in all, I don't think ADP value matters too much for your playoff performance, which is what we care about the most. It does help your advance rate for sure, and getting ADP value will give you that higher floor. So it does become a little bit of a personal preference in what you value advance rate versus potential playoff performance and having the right stacks. So that's my submission for the best ball data roll. Thanks again for giving me a chance to talk about it, and good luck to the rest of the finalists.
So, Sam, I remember when we did our first best ball data roundtable a few months ago, I remember bringing up this kind of interesting dynamic with best ball research and data where it almost always comes back to, are you optimizing for advance rate in the regular season or are you optimizing for the playoffs? And a lot of times we just have more data around advancement rate and more teams and more to look at. But then that's tough to reconcile with this idea, hey, all the money is in week 17 going to a handful of teams. So what did you think about this submission? I found it pretty interesting that the ADP value wasn't too big of a deal when it came to some of his findings.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest takeaway for me reading through his paper was, again, reaching on a quarterback is not going to kill you. So many times I'm on the clock and I've got, you know, two or three pieces of an offense and the quarterback is sitting there, but it would be five or six spots ahead of ADP. And I'm like, well, I need to get ADP value on this. Like, not having the quarterback isn't going to kill me. And so sort of knowing that it wasn't a big boon to, or I guess a big detriment to advance rate, I think is huge. And then the way that he pointed out specific stacks from last year, I thought was really good, because again, like, there is this macro level of, you know, do stacks help, but it's like, it depends on what stack you get. Like, if you get Hurts, Smith, Brown last year, like, you're winning no matter what. And so there is some nuance that comes with that. And with that stack specifically, like, thinking about it this year, like, you're going to need to get ADP value somewhere to complete that stack now. And so when you look at that, when we look at that next year, like, you might not necessarily have a stack that falls into one of these categories, but could be a difference maker anyway.
Ben and Nick, what did you guys think about the overall kind of methodology? I think, you know, the clarity of his submission is what stood out. It's very actionable. It's questions I get all the time, and he really took some of those head on. But what did you guys think about how he approached it from a data perspective?
Yeah, I thought this was a highly relevant and clear submission. There wasn't any like crazy like data science stuff, so it was pretty easy for someone who doesn't have like a data science background to come in and, you know, pick it up. And I also thought, you know, his writing and stuff was really good. Personally, as someone who's like newer to the best ball community, I really like the topic he picked, just because, like, for me personally, like, when I'm drafting and stuff, like, ADP value and stacking is like two heuristics I have in mind when I'm, you know, making a pick. It's just, am I getting ADP value on this pick, or, you know, does it help me in terms of like stacking correlation? So I think it was a really good topic, because he kind of looked at, you know, how much you can sacrifice ADP value for stacking and stuff like that. So overall, I really like this submission.
What about you, Nick?
Yeah, I actually was really, like, when I was drafting earlier in the summer, trying to be kind of like a bully with Baltimore stacks, just because I'm a Todd Monken guy myself. So it was interesting. He kind of, like, I felt like he read my mind with that. Like, do I, because there are certain drafts where you get Lamar Jackson and Mark Andrews to fall to you naturally, but that's pretty rare, especially now as they kind of steam up and get closer together in ADP. Thinking about Jalen Hurts, Devonta Smith, AJ Brown, the double stack with Joe Burrow, T. Higgins, Jamar Chase, like, it's kind of interesting to hear from him say, like, ignore the ADP value and go get those guys if you think they're the ones you need. And then I want to kind of, if Chris were here, I would ask what he thought, just without maybe doing the data work quite yet, extending that to game stacks, because there's not a whole lot of three-person pairs within that top 48. But if you extend that out, like, now Tyreek Hill plus Mark Andrews plus Lamar Jackson, like, do I want to be a bully with ADP there? So really, really relevant. That's where this submission shined the most.
Yep. Awesome stuff there from Chris. Very strong submission. He also does a lot of good work over at Fantasy Points. And one thing I want to mention too, with all these submissions, we're kind of doing a high level overview. One of the things about the Best Ball Data Bowl that's great, and I've mentioned this before, all of these submissions are publicly available to go through literally line by line of the code via the GitHub repository. I'll have the links down below. You can also go to fantasydatapros.com, click the Data Bowl link, and then you'll be taken to the GitHub. You can scroll through that, even see the updates, the changes they made as they added things throughout. So I think that's one of the cool parts of this process, is just how transparent it is. And if you want to go try to recreate stuff or do a remix of someone's study and approach it from a different way, all of that information is there for you. But now we are going to bring on our next guest. I absolutely loved this submission. It was from Aiden here. How do I say your Twitter handle? I'm trying to read this here. Tis Onion Wings. What are we
it's
doing?
I pronounce it Tystonian Wing. So it's something that I've had for a while. It's basically the all four of the professional Detroit sports team mascots combined together there. So Tigers, Pistons, Lions, Red Wings.
Okay. There you go. All right. I love it. And so your submission was about exploring the impact of unique player combos. This is something I've been thinking about a lot. It's something I've gone out of my way to do in drafts. I was recently reviewing my best ball portfolio and noticed some like real blind spots of guys that I have together over and over, not because they're correlated on a team level or a playoff level, but simply because their ADPs line up that they naturally end up on teams. And so your thought process of exploring whether we should go and pursue unique combos, I found highly relevant. Why don't you kind of give just an overview of your submission and kind of the problem you were looking to solve?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about too, both last year and this year. And initially I kind of wanted to compare like getting unique at the top of the draft versus the end. Because, you know, in my mind, my prior was, well, it's a given that getting unique at any point is a good thing. So, you know, maybe we can kind of quantify exactly, you know, the drawbacks and benefits in terms of advance rate and finals win rate and that kind of thing. And then I switched to just looking at the first four rounds because I realized I was going to blow past all the length requirements here. But, I thought this was kind of be like simple analysis to start. I just looked at every team's player combination through the first three, and first four rounds, and then looked at kind of the percent of teams that had those same players throughout their entire roster, right? So like you wouldn't get the benefit of taking, you know, Chase, Higgins, Burrow in the first three to be unique because, you know, there are teams that take those three through four or five rounds or whatever. And then I kind of ran into something interesting was that I kept showing that the unique teams were actually really, really struggling in comparison to the teams that just kind of stuck to the draft board through the first four rounds and had, you know, some of the most common combinations throughout every team in the tournament. And so I thought, okay, well maybe, you know, the goal is to kind of look at, you know, if you have a good team, like, you know, uniqueness isn't really going to matter until the finals anyway. And there's only really good teams in the finals. So maybe you have to figure out a way to kind of filter out the, like quote bad teams that don't really have a chance. And so that's kind of why I built kind of a simple model that ranked teams based on advance rate, expected advance rate, and looked at kind of, okay, let's just look at the teams that are stacking well, are allocating the correct kind of capital to each position, not just like reaching by four rounds for every pick, that kind of thing. And then I saw the same thing that the really unique teams, especially ones who reached at the beginning of the draft, weren't performing well pretty much, you know, at any point of the tournament, right? And so this surprised me. Obviously at the beginning, you know, I had thought that it would matter and would matter a lot. But then I kind of started to think about it and it sort of started to make more sense to me. You know, like if we compare it to DFS, it's usually not the like 8K wide receiver that's winning you the tournament. It's the guy that you got at 2% that goes off for 30 points. Right. And so, the way I can kind of quickly summarize it is that like the top of the draft isn't, it's not going to win you the tournament, but it can definitely lose you the tournament. So, like just kind of going, and kind of sticking with ADP, I kind of made that joke at the end that you can pretty much just auto draft the first four rounds. And I think that you would probably be okay. The one thing is the teams that get a ton of ADP value at the top of the draft, like pretty much just like dominate through the regular season and the playoffs. So that's kind of the one thing that, you know, if you're gifted a value, just take it. And then the flip side to that is if you're reaching, you know, in the first round, where you're like almost by definition giving your opponents values and better players. And we know just, you know, through data and intuition that the gap between players in the first round and then going down is as big as it's ever going to be. Right. So you just really, you know, in my mind, I just like, you really just don't want to think too hard at the beginning. Right. So again, I was a little bit surprised by my results here. Like I said, thinking about it makes more sense. But you know, obviously I would be, if someone came in and did the same study with a different method and came up with a different conclusion, I would definitely be willing to kind of move my thought back over the line. But yeah, that's kind of the big overview there.
Yeah, awesome stuff. And one of the things I did appreciate that you didn't force a conclusion, because I don't do projects like this, but I imagine there's sometimes a tendency of like, man, it would be fun to really reveal reaching for these unique combos is the skeleton key to best ball. But for you to kind of just be honest and transparent with what your work showed, I thought was a good way to stay grounded with that. Sam, do you have any questions from this project here? You mentioned that it was something you were interested at looking into.
No questions specifically. I mean, to bounce off that, Pete, I think with projects like this, like it's almost just impossible to figure out like what conclusions there aren't than what conclusions there are. And Aiden, I think your point, your comment that you can't, you know, lose the tournament in the first round, but excuse me, you can't win it, but you can lose it. I think that's an adage that's been around in fantasy football for a long time, I think really rung true. And I think would have loved to see a lot more too about like the uniqueness aspects of some of these last round picks too, that are like not, you know, not being 100% drafted as well. Like, does that impact advance rates in the playoffs as well? But again, overall, very, very interesting stuff.
Ben and Nick, any follow-up questions or comments here on Aiden's submission?
Yeah, I had one. I think this would be helpful for the audience. Can you offer any explanation as to why you think underdog best ball in particular is really efficient? And for maybe people at home that might want to apply some of these concepts to their home leagues coming up, do you think that kind of translates to redraft at all?
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, underdog probably has the most attention on it in terms of like best ball platforms now. Obviously they have the biggest tournaments. I think a lot of attention and percentage of players who are really sharp and really paying attention to the ins and outs, like in day to day, is what kind of really, really hammers those rankings, those ADPs into efficiency. And I think like in terms of home leagues, like unless you're going, like you're not, well, I don't know. I mean, unless you're going like super deep, like you can probably just copy paste these ranks. I mean, that's probably what I would do too. But yeah, I mean, I was like pretty shocked by the you know, conclusion that even just like two or three picks of value either way, like really made a big difference. Like it's pretty surprising how well these ranks kind of end up being the truth in my mind.
And any other final words on this submission?
I had a couple questions, but I think they're all answered. Just want to say I really like the submission. I think you tackled, you know, an element of the game we hear about, but I hadn't really seen anyone dig into. So it was really interesting, like reading your submission and stuff.
Yeah. And I think the thing, and I just did a kind of a deep dive, like reviewing my portfolio. And one of the things I'd been noticing too, as I was saying, is some of these players that are still in like a similar tier and even ADP cluster, but even just shifting like four to five picks past ADP, I wasn't getting those because I draft off of ADP so much. And then wondering, maybe there's a happy medium of like gently moving off ADP opposed to doing like a wild reach, you know, to get unique. And I'm sure there's levels of kind of like specificity and parsing that data that could maybe reveal more interesting things, but we probably need more data, right, Aiden?
Yeah, probably. And I mean, like, okay, like I wouldn't think too much about having a bunch of the same combo in the first two rounds. Like, okay, like if you have, you know, Devontae and Wilson, well, you know, I have Devontae and like some other really good player too. Like the separation you're getting isn't that great in the end. But I'm definitely excited for other people to kind of to build off this.
Well, awesome. We really appreciate you coming by. Loved reading your submission. As I've been mentioning, I'll have all of these linked down below in the show notes. You guys can go and read through them in their entirety. Aiden, thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Next up, we have Sacrilegious. You guys saw him kind of tease this submission on Best Ball Breakfast a few weeks back. Got the final version uploaded for the contest. This was one I was super excited for. Sacrilegious, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell people who didn't catch your Best Ball Breakfast appearance what you and Hacker tackled and some of your findings here?
Yeah, will do. Thanks for having me, Pete and the Data Pros. So this actually wasn't my first idea for a data bowl submission. I completed a couple other projects and I found results that I thought were noteworthy, but they were a little more descriptive in nature. And with the proper critical thinking and nuance applied to them, I definitely think those other submissions had actual takeaways. But the reason I landed on why advance rate is broken is because I feel like these metrics that we've come up with are going to be fundamental moving forward for best ball research in the future. So the motivation behind tackling this project was solving a problem that was already pretty well known and discussed in the best ball space. People have talked about how noisy advance rate is. You know, we've got the Eno Benjamin problem. We have the Sky Moore problem from last season. This wasn't some big secret that I uncovered. People knew this was a problem, that advance rate in the way that we were looking at it was not giving us as much signal as we desired from it. And so I just took an approach where I tried to extract and remove as much noise as possible from advance rate and some other metrics and provide a more signal-rich version of those metrics that other analysts can use in the future either to revisit historical best ball research projects or build on this and, you know, push forward in the field of best ball research. So that was kind of my motivation behind the project and how I landed on it.
Yeah. And for people who aren't familiar with the Eno Benjamin problem that Sacrilegious is referencing, this was a couple years ago. Eno Benjamin did basically nothing. That's his MO as someone who drafts him a lot, but had a really good regular season advance rate. And it's like, well, that makes no sense. Why did teams who drafted this bad player advance so many teams? Well, it was in that case, it was self-selecting as a lot of sharp drafters. And now I'm going to pat myself on the back. We're selecting Eno Benjamin in basically advancing teams like in spite of Eno's poor problem. And so I thought what was cool, what you did, Sacrilegious, is you really kind of pulled out that noise and then basically re-ran these players on all of these different lineups to get different context. And then you found like a truly, you know, agnostic way to look at how valuable that player was. Is that a fair kind of description of what you guys did?
Yeah, well put, Pete. And so that's one aspect of the noise is skilled drafters versus unskilled drafters potentially having a bias to select specific players. And I think that we can all agree that best ball is a game of skill. There's a lot of luck involved in best ball, but there are ways that we can display skill and try to improve our chances of winning money when the luck hits us in the face, if that makes sense. And so that was part of the noise, that good drafters were taking these players. For example, Sky Moore last season, a lot of sharp drafters, people that are consuming lots of content, people that are plugged in, really liked Sky Moore last season. But just because you're a good drafter doesn't mean that you're always going to be right with your player takes, or even more specifically, that the specific outcome of a sample of one season is going to bear out in a way that's beneficial for you. And so that's why that's a noisy part of advance rate. the other noisy part of advance rate is that players are combined at different frequencies. For example, with Sky Moore, he was drafted really often with Patrick Mahomes. Patrick Mahomes was great for your advance rate. He did a lot to actually help teams advance to the playoffs. But Sky Moore didn't really do anything at all. He didn't really add very many roster points over the course of the regular season, but he still sported a better advance rate than he should have. And that's because he was tethered to Patrick Mahomes and being drafted by drafters that were more consistently constructing better rosters on the whole. And so the methodology behind how I tried to extract as much signal as possible from advance rate is actually pretty simple when I explain it in the context of just one draft room. So I want you to think of just one draft room, 12 teams, and for the most part, players that are selected early enough, you know, first 180, 190 picks, they're getting selected in 100% of draft rooms. And so for this example, let's just use Sky Moore. So in our hypothetical 12-team room here, one of these teams has Sky Moore. What I want to solve for is that roster agnostic advance rate. I want to know how would each of these teams do if they had been the one that drafted Sky Moore. And so the methodology is pretty simple. For the team that already has Sky Moore, I don't need to do anything. That team already gave me the real result that they had. Did they or did they not advance with Sky Moore? For the other 11 teams, what I need to do is just swap Sky Moore onto the roster. And all that I'm doing there is I'm replacing the player that's closest in ADP to Sky Moore that also is the same position as Sky Moore. And I won't go too deep into the reasoning why there were the positional constraints and how we did the specific bands of tolerance for ADP swaps. But essentially, we wanted it to be something where we weren't putting Sky Moore on a team where it really wouldn't have made sense to take Sky Moore if the team needed a different position. And so by doing this, we, I'll use the buzzword that people love, we simulated the results of this specific draft with Sky Moore on each different team, one at a time. It's not like we threw Sky Moore on all 12 teams and said, who won? We did it one at a time. Now, there's a couple nuances in the methodology that lead to some interesting characteristics of this metric. One of them is when we put Sky Moore on a team, if one of the two teams that was advancing already had Sky Moore, what we're effectively testing then is a 17 versus 17 for the rest of the roster. We're saying, was this combo of 17 players better than the combo of 17 players that already had advanced with Sky Moore? And so we've got a little bit of a sampling bias in testing the advance rate because we're testing against teams that were already good enough to advance. And so that ends up giving us kind of a unique output when we look at the roster agnostic advance rate. And I've got to thank Pat Corain for this one because he suggested that instead of calling it RAR, like I initially was going to call it RARE because of this little wrinkle in it. And that's, most players are going to show a negative differential. That is that their normal advance rate or the old way of calculating advance rate, that's going to be better than their roster agnostic advance rate because the old way isn't specifically biasing for testing against these already good teams that advanced. And so we end up with most players showing that negative differential. I believe the actual results were only 15 players had a positive differential where their roster agnostic advance rate was actually better than the advance rate that got reported with the traditional methodology. And so that's why Pat suggested to call it RARE, because a player that outperforms their advance rate truly is pretty rare.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I think, you know, this submission, you know, like you said, it's more providing tools for better analysis going forward, because advance rate is such a common thing that we rely on to judge all of these things, the quality of a roster construction, the quality of player selection, you know, all of these things. We use advance rate as one of our only measures of success. And so you finding a better way to measure that success, I think, is very innovative here. Sam, did you have any thoughts on this submission?
Yeah, really cool way of looking at things. I had done something similar a couple of years ago, looking at essentially advance rate added and did it a slightly different way. But where I got stuck was trying to find specific ways to apply that to, I guess, different draft strategies and macro elements of it. Because it's an interesting way to measure against specific players. And again, like with the Sky Moore, with the, you know, Benjamin stuff, essentially boil down their specific value to a best ball roster. But curious if there was anything else that you had looked at that you're now considering in your drafts that you're doing, knowing that, okay, a guy like Sky Moore might not be as valuable in the tournament.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Sam. And I, my biggest takeaway is I don't want this to be something where people are looking at this as a descriptive thing for, oh, Sky Moore bad, me no click Sky Moore anymore. The way that I see it most valuably applied is in turning over stones that people have already looked under and just using this as a slightly more refined tool to improve historical best ball research. And then I cannot wait to see what better analysts than myself do with this going forward, because I think this is really just going to help open the door to some other research topics that I'm really excited to see. I'll give a really small example of one of the projects I'm working on right now with one of the other metrics that I came up with, and that's APPA, or average player points added. And so the player points added, or points above replacement, is something that people have talked about in the fantasy space for a long time. But APPA just follows that same player swapping methodology that I came up with. And really all that it's doing is giving us a larger sample size of different textured rosters where we're just getting to better analyze the points that a player actually contributes to a roster. All it's doing, I'm really not doing anything terribly complex. What I'm doing is just trying to pull as much noise out as I possibly can to give people a better tool. And so what I'm using APPA for is actually going back and looking at what I think is some really quality best ball research that another analyst had done, and that's Mike Leone's draft capital model that he provided in the Best Ball Manifesto. So what I did with Mike's model is I applied a very similar methodology, but I just used APPA as an input to the model. And so I came up with a slightly more refined version of the model where I'm using just a tiny bit less noise in the input, just through the methodology that I used with APPA instead. And so that gave me draft capital that I feel is going to be ever so slightly more accurate to how we should actually look at draft capital and use that information to inform our decisions as we're constructing teams in the future. I hope I explained that okay.
For sure. Ben and Nick, any final questions on this submission?
Yeah, I was wondering, I know that like this reminded me a lot of, I believe Hayden Winks kind of pointed out that zero RB drafters were drafting the same players versus your, I guess, tape guys were drafting different in specific types of running backs. Did you see any of that come out in your analysis in terms of identifying or pairing up certain types of these like overarching strategies with certain players that either advanced more often than other players?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something where I'm gonna put out the call to other fantasy analysts out there. Please dive into this stuff. It is so rich for more analysis. I do not have the time to do all of it. I have lots of other projects I am working on, and I just won't
Amen
have the time
that.
To do all the analysis that this is opening a door to so much more opportunity. And so it's rich. I'm just trying to set the table so other people can go even farther than I went. But one example that I really loved was, if you look at Josh Jacobs absolutely smashed, you know, the stone best pick in best ball last season, as far as advance rate is concerned. You know, what he did in the playoffs, a little unlucky for those poor Josh Jacobs teams. But for advance rate, Josh Jacobs was incredible. What we actually saw, though, is Josh Jacobs had a negative rare differential. Josh Jacobs was being drafted by teams that we can assume were constructed less well than the teams that were not drafting Josh Jacobs, because Josh Jacobs should have advanced 6% more frequently than he actually did, which, when you think about how high his advance rate already was, I believe it's 41% or something off the top of my head, for him to go far, it's not a linear increase. Going from 41% to 47% is a big increase. Like that's a lot more teams that are advancing. And again, like I mentioned, he's competing against good teams. In this methodology, we're testing against really good teams that were already advancing, and he still was able to improve his advance rate. And so to me, that just shows that there's definitely something to the idea of there are good drafters and there are less good drafters. And that can really matter. And player takes is only one little part of it. And, you know, good drafters and bad drafters, they can be right on their player takes just as often as they're wrong on their player takes. But the results of a specific player definitely can be skewed by the rosters that they're drafted on, if I explain that well.
For sure. Ben, any final thoughts here for Sacrilegious?
I was actually going to ask a question about the methodology he uses, so the player swapping. Originally, my question was for the other metrics, but it seems as though all the metrics are using the same methodology. So do you think that this can be applied to like even more metrics besides the ones you came up with here?
Yeah, 100%. We had a couple other metrics that we were looking at. To be frank, I ran out of computing time. We were running into a deadline and I was going on vacation at the end of the month and I knew I needed to get my submission in. Right. And I actually, just a little how the sausage is made side story here, I unfortunately had a failure and I wrote over one of my results files and I was so panicked. I was not going to be able to get this done in time because it had been like weeks of computing time. And so I reached out to Hacker, and Hacker was awesome in playing a role in this submission because I came up with the idea. I built my code. I had a pretty good understanding of what needed to be done, how to do it. But I'm a relative novice at programming. And so I really wanted to be able to have that sense of pride of say, I did this myself. I learned from, you know, basically knowing nothing. I taught myself enough to be able to do this project and execute it and get the result that I desired. And so everything was humming along. It was going well. And then I had that failure and I reached out to Hacker and said, dude, I just burned like multiple weeks of computing time and we are up against it. Can you please look at my code and see if there's a way that I could be doing this more efficiently? Because I know there is. I'm making novice mistakes in this because I am a novice. So can you, a more experienced programmer, look at this and help me improve it? And he had some really simple suggestions where when someone who knows better than you gives you advice and you get to stand back, oh my gosh, I was so dumb for not thinking of that. Just splitting up the JSON files that we were loading from into 10 instead of one, where I'm like, I'm at risk of having a memory error and whoops, my computer just crashed, was so smart. And that saved so much time and made things so much more efficient. And then being able to reuse a lot of the calculations that I had already done, it was just those little things. And that was one of the most beautiful parts of this whole project to me, is just getting to grow and learn more stuff and learn from people better than you are. And honestly, I'm regretting not taking the Fantasy Data Pros course, because I'm sure that if I had taken it at the outset of the project, I probably would have saved myself a bunch of time. And I wouldn't have had to learn from making mistakes myself. I could have had the benefit of learning from people who just had more knowledge than me in the area. But yeah, this was such an awesome experience. I had a ton of fun and I really appreciate you guys putting this on.
Well, thank you so much, Sacrilegious. Really enjoyed your submission and do hope people take you up on your offer to dig into it further. Also, thank you for that segue too. You know, if you guys want to sign up for the Fantasy Data Pros course so you can do stuff like this, our guy Lou Dog took the course this spring, early summer, and then submitted his own, you know, Best Ball Data Bowl piece in here on looking at bye week. So he went from 0 to 60 really fast thanks to that course. So you guys can get 25% off with promo code Pete. I got the link down below. We are going to bring on Dan now, who had a submission that was very near and dear to my heart. I had just put out a video about the wide receiver avalanche, how my rooms are insane this year. And you actually looked at what was going on, trying to quantify how different is this year from last year. And can you actually survive it? Do you have to capitulate? All of that good stuff. So Dan, welcome to the show. And thank you for tackling a project near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, and of course. And if I can come and bring some accolades to this stream, if you look at the most wide receiver heavy drafts from BBM3, number one is your first ship chasing draft at the beginning of Best Ball Mania, and number two is a Best Ball Breakfast draft. So just to give people just some sort of framing of how wide receiver heavy ship chasing drafts are. They're literally number one and number two. But yeah, that's pretty much the genesis of this idea. I think one of the coolest and frankly most under-discussed aspects of best ball is in draft room draft dynamics and what happens when the draft actually starts. There's like letting the draft come to you, but then there's also building the best team that the draft room is going to let you build. So my purpose here was to sort of quantify something that we all experience in draft rooms, which is what happens when there's a run at a position, just exploring like what does that actually do to the draft board and different strategies you can take to just handle the avalanche. So the way I went about this and the workhorse of the entire project is this metric that I developed called wide receiver over expectation. And it's basically a way for using ADP to check against the draft itself. So the methodology behind it is you take the draft, you mark every time a wide receiver, running back, quarterback, or tight end was drafted, and then you cumulatively sum them until you get a running total of how many positions at each portion of the draft were taken. And then you use ADP to do that exact same thing. Now, there are going to be some slight differences where people have an ADP of 44.1 and 44.2, and that might not be completely reflective of where they were taken, but you sort the draft by ADP. You just change their ADPs to 1 through 2006 to 216 to merge it all back. And you basically use that ADP to do the same thing. You take a sum of how many positions were expected to be taken if the draft simply followed ADP. And then you can use those two things and you could subtract them to get the difference. So you subtract how many wide receivers were expected to be taken against how many wide receivers were actually taken. And this gives you this nice wide receiver metric where you could look at any pick in the draft and you can say, at pick number 37, there were four wide receivers taken above expectation. And then in order to make that comparable across the whole draft, you scale the metric. So at any point, you can say at this point in the draft, like the amount of wide receivers above expectation is one standard deviation above the mean, 1.5 standard deviations above the mean, and so on. And what that does is that allows us to have a tool to start to describe what a wide receiver run is. And this part of the process was a little bit arbitrary, but for my purposes, I wanted to define a wide receiver run as something that felt like what a wide receiver run feels like when you're in a draft room. So I defined a wide receiver run as a range of 8 picks where the wide receiver over expectation was at least one standard deviation above the mean. And within those 8 picks, more than half of those picks would be wide receivers. Because you get into wide receiver runs and sometimes people take a running back, people might take a quarterback. And there's a bunch of different ways you can quantify this. It's a trade-off between pretty much like sample size. If you increase the thresholds, then you're getting more pronounced wide receiver runs. And if you decrease the thresholds, you're getting less pronounced wide receiver runs, but you're getting a larger sample. And then basically the first step in my research was seeing like what actually happens when there's a wide receiver run. And from an ADP perspective, I looked at it from positional ADP. So rather than, let's say, looking at James Cook's like individual ADP, I looked at what his positional ADP is. So right now he's going about like the running back 31. So in each draft, it's taking what the ADP of the running back 31 was rather than James Cook's individual ADP. And basically what you see is during a wide receiver run is that wide receivers are taken at a 6 to 7% premium. And running backs can be taken anywhere from an 8 to an 11% discount, with quarterbacks and tight ends falling a little bit below where running backs are, but they're still taken at a discount. And going off that, we know, okay, I know that a wide receiver run is happening. I know, like, in a classic, like, ship chasing room 1 year, like, Michael Pittman's going at, like, the 1-2 turn. Like, what's going on here? But then the next point is like, what do you actually do when there's a wide receiver run? And only looking at advance rates and regular season scoring. I looked at it from, was it beneficial to take a running back, quarterback, or tight end to take a detour during the run, or was it better to capitulate and take a wide receiver during the run? And what I found was pretty surprising in that both BBM2 and BBM3 showed that the opposite approaches could work. In BBM2, when there are wide receivers, when there was a wide receiver run going on, it was really beneficial to still take that wide receiver because most often the wide receivers going in that run were advanced rate superstars like Deebo Samuel, Ja'Marr Chase, and Cooper Kupp. And even though they were getting taken at a premium at ADP, like, it was still important to take them because at the same time, the running backs who were going were landmines. Like, Travis Etienne got hurt in the middle of the offseason that year. You had Raheem Mostert, who went down really early in the season. And then you have everyone's favorite classic dead zone back, Mike Davis, who, even if you're taking him at a discount, you're still not gaining much. And then last year in BBM3, it was the complete opposite approach where you had, where taking a detour was really beneficial because you had Josh Jacobs with a monster advance rate. You had quarterbacks like Patrick Mahomes and Jalen Hurts who provided a monster advance rate. And then once you got to the wide receiver, there are still some successes, like notably like Amon-Ra St. Brown. But to the extent that they helped your team's advance and to the extent that they helped your team score in the regular season, it wasn't as much as those running backs and quarterbacks. So that kind of showed me that either approach could work, and it's extremely heavily influenced by the players who are being selected in those ranges. And then the next step is to just go in and say, all right, like, what happens in wide receiver heavy rooms? What happens in the prototypical like avalanche room? Like, wide receivers are continually going about 5 to 10%, like, at a premium compared to where they would go in a normal draft. What should we do then? So basically what I did is I sorted each draft room by the how wide receiver heavy it was in the first 9 rounds. And then I did something very similar to what Hayden Winks has done in the past, which has shown like regular season scoring across different rounds. And that, again, surprised me because my first intuition was in a wide receiver avalanche room, you would want to take wide receivers earlier and often. It would be even more important to grab 5 receivers by round 9, maybe in like a wide receiver heavy room, you would want to get it by round 7 or round 8. And what I pretty much found is that it's still important to grab 4 to 5 wide receivers by round 7 or by round 9, but it didn't have that same magnetic effect as it did for non-wide receiver heavy rooms, where taking them earlier, taking them more often was what you should do in a quote-unquote optimal setting. So I think at the end of the day, the research was very descriptive, but it showed that both approaches can work as long as you're price conscious, as long as you're still building strong foundational teams with sound principles. And it's just something to keep in mind heading into Best Ball Mania 4, where the rooms are already so wide receiver heavy to begin with, that maybe if you get a falling value on a running back, or if you get a falling value on a running back, like, these just might be key features of drafts moving forward. Like, everyone wants to say who the next Josh Jacobs is, but I think a more helpful example is like, who is the next Miles Sanders going to be? Like, who's that running back going in round 7 who, I mean, frankly, he had a really good year, but it was like 1200 yards and 10 to 13 touchdowns or so. And maybe if you're in one of these wide receiver avalanche rooms and you see one of your running backs at a discount, I know everyone has different picks, but if you see someone like a Damian Pierce, if you see, I know some people are hedging a little bit on Isaiah Pacheco, but someone who's in an elite offense who could walk into a 10 touchdown season, or if you see someone like a J.K. Dobbins who is falling, especially, I know this is an underdog stream, but on DraftKings, where his ADP is literally like 88 right now, maybe taking a shot on one of those guys and taking the risk that, like, maybe my wide receiver 5 is going to be like Nico Collins, or maybe my wide receiver 5 is going to be a Jacoby Myers type player, and taking advantage of that running back value. Like, I think that can be something that's valuable moving forward, especially with how wide receiver heavy these rooms are. And that's at a big view, like sort of where I'm taking like the research into drafts this season.
Awesome stuff. I want to toss it around to the panel real quick, but I did want to pull one insane stat that you had at the end of your piece. You said BBM Force current ADP through 10 rounds would be the sixth heaviest wide receiver room in all of BBM3. So like we're not just making things up. We're like, oh, it feels like it's wide receiver heavier this year. No, like the landscape is meaningfully different, and it was fun to see you tackle that project. Sam, any thoughts on this submission?
I thought it was really good. I think my favorite projects just personally are ones where, again, you hear a phrase or something like that, and then you think of an idea based off of that and trying to quantify it in some way. So the whole wide receiver avalanche thing, taking that from ship chasing, I thought was really cool. And then, you know, one thing that I think is important with all of this is tying it back to specific players too, because that influences things so much with advance rate, all this sort of stuff. And so breaking it down again, show some of the charts you had showing each of the specific players and whether teams participated or didn't participate in a wide receiver run with those specific guys and the impact they had, I thought was very good.
What about you, Nick and Ben? Any thoughts on this one? I know you guys aren't as steeped in the wide receiver avalanches as I am, but did this one hit home for you?
Yeah, that stat you mentioned was pretty incredible. And that like spurred a question for me is another thing that like a clear trend we're seeing is quarterbacks are getting steamed up as well, just because so many elite rushing and throwing quarterbacks that are throwing so many touchdowns. Both of those positions have kind of pushed up a little bit in BBM4 compared to the other two best ball manias. And I think that comes at a bit of a running back discount. So I guess like my question is, should we still be drafting, in your opinion, like wide receivers even heavier? So I know the rule you mentioned was like get 5 by round 9. And then in that heavy room, 5 by round 7, if you see it start to get heavy, is it 5 through round 5 and don't take any more detours this year? Or where are you at with that? Because I know you are in the drafts a lot, it seems.
Yeah, that's a great question, because also the rooms being wide receiver heavy isn't only a function of running backs being cheaper. It's that we have 4 quarterbacks that are going in the top 40 picks this year, which is also pushing the running back prices down. And if you look at the data, both like when you take a detour to take a quarterback, it has been successful and in certain circumstances, almost as successful as taking a running back. And the reason why that is because you have someone like Patrick Mahomes last year, you have someone like Jalen Hurts, who was an extreme value relative to how he performed last year. So taking that into drafts moving forward, I think a lot of times this is the area where I'd say be very player conscious and and believe in the players that you're taking. So something, and it depends a lot on your draft position, because something that I've found is if you draft, let's say in the back half of the draft, and let's say you've taken one wide receiver and then you came back and you took like, let's say Bijan in the second round. A lot of times in these wide receiver heavy rooms, like you're really, and I like some of these guys, but I feel like it's a tier break where you're staring down like Amari Cooper, Jerry Jeudy, Christian Kirk as like your wide receiver too, where often, like, let's say I can go into one of these wide receiver heavy rooms. I can take, let's say, CeeDee Lamb and Amon-Ra St. Brown at the 1-2 turn. Or even if you want to get crazy with uniqueness, take CeeDee Lamb and like Jalen Waddle at the 1-2 turn. Then on the way back, what I can do is I can take like a Mark Andrews, I can take a Lamar Jackson, and then take that falling running back value at the same time, where I can take like maybe a Breece Hall, maybe take a Jahmyr Gibbs, maybe, again, not somebody people super love this year, but take a Travis Etienne. And then all throughout the draft, you still have the opportunity to sprinkle in running backs if you want to continue to draft wide receivers. So you can take a Damian Pierce or a Cam Akers at a discount. You can take a J.K. Dobbins in the 7th round. You can take like a Brian Robinson in the 8th round, and you can still round out a running back room that way. So I think really what the research showed is that anything could work. The one pause that I would have is that it was like a small sample size. It was just 5% of the most draft heavy rooms from BBM2 and BBM3, but the data didn't necessarily show that like taking more wide receivers and taking them earlier was beneficial for advance rates and regular season scoring. So I would maybe be more open to more running back or like four wide receivers through 9 rounds. And then it's a separate conversation from playoff scoring, because it's sort of a double-edged sword, because the wide receivers are going earlier, but also the earlier wide receivers are where all the spike weeks are coming from. So you want to build a team that's built to advance out of a wide receiver avalanche room, but where you still have the firepower to advance in the playoffs and actually have the actually be able to fill your wide receiver 1, your wide receiver 2, your wide receiver 3, and then even your flex spot in the playoffs. So I think it's a trade-off. It's something that's definitely unique to this drafting environment where you have so many running backs that are discounted. So the way I would prefer to build is get some wide receiver firepower early and then sprinkle in running backs through the draft so that you're still taking them at a value. They still might be players who can help you advance to the playoffs. And then at the same time, like, make sure you're covered at wide receivers so you have the spike weeks for the playoffs and you're getting the best of both worlds. Because I wouldn't want to have 2 wide receivers through 9 rounds and then just find myself hoping for like a DJ Chark, like Zay Jones correlation to help me win week 17 or something like that.
Yeah, and I think like a big thing for me, what your a big takeaway would be, you know, reverse engineering your draft is important. Mm-hmm. Like if you have conviction in those players where it's like, I think I can get an RB2 in the 12th round and I'm going to build a portfolio around that, it allows me to, you know, maybe pass on, you know, wide receivers or whatever, because you know that you have that in your back pocket. And so feeling conviction in the kind of production you can get later in the draft will go a long way. If you start looking at the landscape and you're like, I don't like any wide receiver after round 10, well, you might just have to capitulate to the wide receiver avalanche. But Ben, before we let go of Dan here, any final thoughts on his submission?
Yeah, I just had one quick question. It was just bouncing off the stat that you mentioned, Pete. My question for Dan is basically, how do you see like the landscape developing, I guess, and future BBM seasons, especially if drafters become more aware of and prepared for positional runs?
I feel like BBM4 is kind of this inflection point where you have a lot of industry analysts who are putting the brakes on, you really can't take like T. Higgins over Josh Jacobs. Like the projections say you need to take Josh Jacobs. Like now we've pushed wide receivers to this edge of the draft where now we're just taking them based on ceiling and they're not even projecting better than the running backs who are going near them. And I think going forward, I would see like wide receiver ADPs holding at what they are, or what Sean Siegel talks about is we had the really strong wide receiver year. I think it was either 2015 or 2016. And then zero RB just completely fell on its face the following year. So I could see like if there's something where, let's say like dead zone backs are just like huge values this year. Like let's say you see like a Miles Sanders or like a Rashad White or like a James Conner be the guy you need to help you in the playoffs. Like I feel like if we have that, there's going to be a big backlash in the other way where maybe we get ADP stabilizing to back to what BBM2 was, but it feels like drafters are drafting with like a ton of information now. They know what the optimal builds are. They know it not necessarily like need to go with a 2.772 or a 2.68. It's like, I need to get like 5 wide receivers before round 9 and building with like a draft capital lens in their back pocket. So I think I see it sort of stabilizing, because I feel like if it goes even heavier the next year, I mean, people were probably thinking this last year as well, like how can it get even more heavier than this? And I'm sure Pete and all of like the best ball breakfast streams you do and the ship chasing rooms you do, like those streams are going to be at the top of the wide receiver heaviness scores like going into next year as well. So I could see it increasing, but it feels like we're at this inflection point, like sort of how analysts are viewing ADP as an industry, where it feels like this is like maybe the most palatable wide receiver prices they'll be able to take. And if those running backs do bounce back, I think people will be itching to take the running backs again.
Yeah. A wise man in this industry once told me on stream that we jumped the shark, wanting to pass on an ADP running back value. So yeah, we might be very much itching toward that. Dan, super great submission, and loved hearing you explain it. Everyone can check it out in its entirety via the GitHub that I'm going to link to down below. But now we are going to bring on screen here. We got Nick. Nick, how do you pronounce your last name for me here?
You got it right the other day. I was pretty stoked about it. It's Batchelder.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. I did nail it. Sight unseen. Welcome to the show here. You had one of the most, I would call it heady submissions. It was one that I had to read through a couple of times to fully grasp what you did. And then I was like, holy cow, this is really cool. So why don't you explain to everyone else what you tackled with this submission here?
Yeah, totally. And thanks so much for having me on. It's nice to see you guys on stream. I guess I would kind of call this like the culmination of like a bunch of my thoughts. I'm glad you got my dog on this.
Yeah.
By the way. But it's kind of the culmination of thoughts that I've had on value-based drafting for a long time, which is usually how I tend to think about drafting both in best ball and otherwise. And really like it's using predictions, and they don't have to be a certain type of prediction. Like I use Fantasy Pros predictions, but you know, you can use your own predictions in a similar system. To kind of draft optimally based on expectation of these players in terms of like long-term regular season fantasy points. And kind of a couple of the big points I would say is the reason why I was so excited to get involved in this best ball data is that, you know, it's really useful for seeing what players did in the past really well and what made players successful. But to me, even more excitingly, it gives the distributions of how people react to ADP. So the distributions of true pick number by ADP. And what that really allows us to do is assign like exact probabilities to when players will be picked by position and ADP in the future. ADP is a really valuable thing, but prior to this competition, there really hasn't been data that gives you the distribution around ADP. And like, you know, an ADP of 120 is a lot less informative than an ADP of like 5, right? Like the variance increases of the distribution over time. And that's like a big takeaway. And really the way that I use it is you can sort of calculate what the best positional player is going to be over time at different points in the draft. So say on pick 56, you can assign a probability to say, you know, there's a 56% chance that so-and-so player is going to be the best running back and stuff like that. So that's what really drives the back of my project. I know you mentioned it's sort of a math heavy project. And I do want to emphasize that, like, I was kind of hesitant to put, you know, the LaTeX in there and kind of all the math background, because really it is something that can be digested in a very intuitive way. And it kind of shapes the way that I like draft intuitively with value-based drafting. And it's not like I'm doing this math while I'm drafting or anything like that. Like it's just part of the process, and it should be something that is relatively understandable to someone, you know, that you don't need a degree in stats for it, right? So basically what I did is come up with these, what I like to call EPL curves, or expected positional loss curves. And what expected positional losses to me is essentially how many regular season fantasy point totals projected are you going to lose by X turn at the running back position over the best running back in the draft, or the highest projected running back in the draft, right? And what that allows us to do is sort of create a I'm very familiar in the past using like VORP, or value of positional replacement, to draft. But I have a lot of qualms with it. And what this does is it allows you to implement more of like a VONA type, or value of next available type metric, to kind of figure out what players are good to draft because of sort of, you know, I love Dan's paper because of the avalanche, what player is the best to take because of the avalanche that may be incoming at a certain position, right? And by doing this, you can sort of say, okay, so on turn 10 in 2021, the most likely best player is going to be I don't remember. I think I had it exactly, but let's say Justin Jefferson, right? Or someone, or maybe it was, let's see, I actually have it here. Give me 1 second. It doesn't matter exactly who, but let's say the first best player is going to be Jonathan Taylor on pick 10. We expect him to be the best player. We can also calculate who's going to be the expected next best player on your next turn. So on turn 10, what would that be? Turn 16, something like that. You can say with a 60% chance, you're going to have Joe Mixon on the board as the best available running back. And what is the difference between the player available now and the player available on your next turn? And how does that relate to the best available player at the tight end position and the best available player at your next turn at the tight end position? And by doing that, you can kind of maximize EPL or maximize expected positional loss throughout your entire draft. And what that does is it maximizes, at least for your starters. So I really suggest doing this with your starters because, you know, you can maximize the projected fantasy points in your first 8-7 players. And then after that, you know, what's really going to bring up your chance of playoff advance rate is picking the best players early. And later on, you know, you can use things like stacking and like maximizing your covariance between players after pick 8 to sort of get that extra 1%, 2% playoff advance rate push with that correlation between players. And you can do that based on the players you pick with value-based drafting early. And then the last thing that I sort of got into a little bit with my paper is that, and the part that can be a little bit confusing and was confusing to me for a long time, is that you don't necessarily want to take the maximum expected positional value, the maximum immediate EPL, right? And the reason for that is you want to maximize roster fantasy points, and in turn, you want to maximize roster EPL. And just like we normalize for the fact that quarterbacks score more points than running backs, and we aren't going to take, you know, Patrick Mahomes first pick. I guess we're getting closer to doing that these days, but you know, we're not going to take him first pick immediately just because he's going to projected to score the most points because we have to pick other positions. We also have to normalize for the fact that we have to pick 3 running backs, whereas we only have to pick 1 quarterback and 1 tight end. And what that means is we need to take wide receiver and running back value when we can get it, because we need to take more of them than the other positions. So say, for instance, in 2022, according to EPL, the best player to take in the first round, hands down, was Travis Kelce. And I kind of get into that, and that's the first half of my paper. But afterwards, I kind of say, you shouldn't take him. You should take Justin Jefferson. And the reason why is because while Travis Kelce maximizes, you know, positional loss before the next turn, Justin Jefferson had really great positional value loss at the wide receiver position. And we have to find, at least for our starters, 3 wide receiver turns where we can get good value at wide receiver, whereas we only have to find 1 at the tight end position. And what I did is kind of, I called it EPL maximization, roster maximization. And really all that was is me simulating every combination of top 8 players that fit a starting roster and seeing which ones maximized EPL and fantasy points. My computer got ridiculously hot doing it. It was absurd. But essentially, what it returned is take wide receivers early this year. And last year, in 2021, Jonathan Taylor's value was so high at the very beginning that it suggested that you take a running back earlier, early in the draft. But really, it kind of showed that the fact that we have to normalize for how many positions we have to take on a roster is kind of overlooked in our sort of current drafting landscape. And I think that's in addition to kind of giving us a way to draft with value, that's really my biggest takeaway from the paper. And I'll definitely be taking wide receivers early this year for sure.
Yeah, I thought this was a super cool submission, and I love how you articulated it. And it's actually, this concept has been put under the magnifying glass with the new weekly winners format on Underdog, which I know you're not covering here, but people really debating, you know, Travis Kelce's going 1-3 in that format because it's like, hey, look at this huge positional edge. I'm competing against thousands and thousands of rosters. And yet when you look at the opportunity costs of Travis Kelce against other first round picks and the ceiling that they could provide, it actually isn't as clear cut that he is actually giving you such an edge, which is kind of what you're exploring here. Sam, do you have any questions for this impressive submission by Nick?
Well, what I will say is you single-handedly changed my view on value over replacement player. I think the is it value over next available, I think is probably the next big shift in a draft strategy or how people apply. Because again, to your point, if Travis Kelce is going to have the same value over replacement player number, regardless of where the other draft tight ends are being drafted. But if there's an 8-round gap between, you know, the tight end one and the tight end two, eventually there's going to be some value with waiting on tight end. And then I think the way you provided specific examples of like, okay, here's from the first draft spot, here's what the optimal lineup or draft would have looked like. And I thought that was a really good way of sort of synthesizing your point of you don't necessarily need to maximize the EPL at every single pick. It's there are a couple of levers you need to pull while you're drafting.
Yeah, definitely. Kind of hitting on your VOPR reference, you know, I kind of talked about a couple of things, and it's not just like the fact that it doesn't hit imminent like value, right? It doesn't like imminent right. drops or imminent avalanches, as Dan would say earlier. But it also is inconsistent over time and it's inconsistent over position, right? Like the median running back, it might have a bigger differential with the best running back than the median quarterback does to the best quarterback, right?
Yeah.
And it also like positional dynamics change every year. So it's a good like start for positional drafting, but it's there's work to be done with it. And like, there's still work to be done now. I think that there should be more work in capturing, normalizing for what I said earlier, where you need to pick a certain, like more positions than in wide receiver than in tight end, that needs to be incorporated in some sort of metric that doesn't involve, you know, simulating a billion combinations of players to figure out, you know, who would the best would have been with some, you know, threshold of 50% availability. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of to venture through. In terms of value-based drafting. And yeah, this definitely has changed the way I think about things too.
Nick, any thoughts on Nick's submission?
Yeah, fellow Nick, shout out to you. I have your submission pulled up and your conclusions here, and I just was almost cracking myself up. You just say, well, that's all. And it was such a complex submission. But I do think this your submission did hit a good balance of taking all that complexity and boiling it down to, okay, what do we do with this in 2023? And yours is one that I actually pulled up during a draft just to see, like, specifically you have this kind of like color map that shows like where to hit certain positions in each round. And I do think it's interesting that I had an aha moment where you kind of suggest that the best possible pick this year is Josh Allen, but then you start to talk about the positional importance and how the fact that you only take one or only start one quarterback a week, that he might not be the best player. And my question was, is let's say Josh Allen's sitting there and there was a certain part of this summer where he was falling 3, 4, 5 spots past ADP. I guess, like, how are you incorporating those types of things happening in a draft while you're drafting with this in mind?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. And my answer is that I'm starkly against drafting quarterbacks early, purely because of this. I think that people are starting to tend to draft quarterbacks early because their value of positional replacement is getting better. I think last year I checked and Josh Allen had like, or maybe it was 2 years ago, had the highest value over positional replacement of any player in the entire league. And that's sort of the thing that's making people shift him earlier in ADP. But the reason why, even if I think I can't remember the turn on which I said he had the most value, which was the highest value turn in the draft. But I think it was
pick 21, I think.
Pick 21. If I had Josh Allen on the board on pick 21, I would not pick Josh Allen. And the reason why is because of that factor that like I've never heard anyone really talk about in depth, which is the fact that you need a lot of wide receivers and you need a lot of running backs. And it would have to be a massive expected positional loss before your next turn to mitigate for the fact that you're giving up on good wide receiver value on that turn. Or there would just have to be no wide receiver value and no running back value, which isn't going to happen that early in a draft. So my answer to that is, you know, there's obviously no right way of doing things. And I'm not saying that drafting to maximize EPL isn't a bad. I'm not saying it's a bad strategy. I'm not saying it couldn't yield good results. But if you're trying to incorporate that kind of factor that you need to normalize for how many of each position you need to take, if you're taking that stance, then I wouldn't take a quarterback until round 8.
Yeah, I was gonna point out that you do kind of advocate for a little bit of a late round QB strategy, which I thought was interesting, and wanted to make sure people listening at home understood that this submission in particular kind of goes against the grain in that regard, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and my wheels are turning because it's fun to see some of, you know, my bro science gut feel takes backed up with some of this data, but it's also interesting to see how wide receivers have been treated on Underdog over the years. And forever it was, hey, this is a half point PPR site. I can start up to 3 running backs. I need to load up on these. And we saw the market finally realize the fact that you can get 4 wide receivers in your starting lineup versus 3 wide receivers legitimately tilts the scales. And it basically took 2 to 3 years for us to reach efficiency on that in the way Dan was subscribing with his submission. Now we have the market, I think, mostly properly, you know, understanding wide receiver value, but it feels like the pendulum is now swung on these elite quarterbacks. A lot of the huge win rates, which came from Jalen Hurts, who was drafted at a much cheaper price tag than where these elite quarterbacks are going this year. And I do think you are going to be the canary in the coal mine when we look at this year, that the opportunity cost of those early quarterbacks, specifically the ones that were going in the second round, is really going to hurt teams in this overall landscape. And obviously weird things can happen, but I have a feeling we're going to have a reckoning there. And I've been drafting a ton of late round quarterback teams, a lot of 3 QB teams. And I do think it might be one of those structural edges that the field is maybe a year too slow to catch up on.
Yeah. And I love the like post eight round quarterbacks. Like I think Dak Prescott's going to do all right. I think Kirk Cousins is going to do all right. Right. And he's super late. So you're getting value there. The other point that I'll make there is, you know, what started this whole like push of QBs to earlier ADPs is, you know, in 2021, Josh Allen started getting pushed. He had great performance. And then in 2022, he got drafted early. But even like, for instance, I have some like plots of advance rates for each position rank 1 through 5. And even if you look at those, like just because a player is the best player doesn't necessarily mean that they're valuable, right? And like, for instance, in 2021, Josh Allen had a 22% advance rate. Tom Brady had a 31% advance rate, right? In 2022, Patrick Mahomes had a 28% advance rate. Jalen Hurts had a 30% advance rate. Really, it's all about value, and like slamming QB value early comes at a really high opportunity cost. So if you're going to double down and do that, you better really believe that that quarterback's going to meet and exceed expectations for the season.
For sure. Ben, any thoughts on this submission? The more we talk it through, the more I feel like there is to chew on here.
Yeah, I think most of my questions were answered. I actually really like the submission because I actually teach value over replacement in my fantasy football course. So I understood your submission pretty well, definitely because it's something, you know, the problems you propose and stuff is something I've already been thinking about for a while. So it's nice to see someone actually put it on paper. I guess a quick question I could ask is the sort of analysis and these metrics that you came up with, do you think that they could be as valuable or even more valuable in other formats? And do you think if you use data sets from a different contest format, do you think you would have gotten like significantly different results?
In terms of whether I think that EPL and VONA implementations are useful in other formats, absolutely. This best ball, honestly, the data bowl kind of got me into best ball and thinking about best ball, but these are thoughts that I've kind of, again, culminated over a couple years of playing a lot of, you know, just normal half PPR fantasy. And you know, like the idea that you need to maximize your starting value first is almost even more applicable in that setting. So I would say to that question, absolutely. You also asked, sorry, what was your second question?
I think my second question was if you use like data sets from a different contest format. Yeah.
So yeah, obviously the distributions of, you know, ADP, true value, or true pick numbers by ADP are going to change slightly. But, you know, if you look at like, even on Fantasy Pros, you can see like the ADP of half PPR compared to best ball, you know, there's differences, but they're similar. And a lot of those differences come later for things like stacking and that sort of thing. So absolutely. And, you know, right now there's no data set for half PPR or full PPR or any of these things that gives us that relationship. So we can't really calculate those probabilities as directly. And I'll definitely be using like the distributions by ADP from best ball for my regular half PPR fantasy league this year. And I'll be drafting very similarly. Because if you're drafting by value early, then, you know, it should be a similar strategy, I believe.
Awesome stuff, Nick. Really great work there. And as I keep mentioning, you guys should really go through all of these submissions. There's so much good stuff, a lot of charts looking at historical data, stuff you guys can apply. And like I said, you can go through, review all of these via the GitHub. Nick, we really appreciate you coming on here. We're going to let you go as we wrap things up. Ben, I'm like, it's going to be hard for us to make a decision here because I've been so impressed with the uniqueness, the methodology, the clarity of all of these submissions. Like, I don't want to say I didn't have high expectations. You never know. First year doing stuff, what's it going to be like? I mean, just really, really strong work from everyone who competed this year.
Yeah, super impressed with the work that everyone put out. I've been doing this for a few years now, like data science and stuff. So I know how much work can go into building out these notebooks. And some of these are easily, you know, 20 plus hours of work. So it's super impressive. Just super impressed with the work everyone put out. And the beauty of this competition, of course, is that everything is truly like open and public. So you don't have to take it, you know, my word up for it. You can just check out the analysis on the GitHub, and everyone's work is on there. So just super impressed. And I want to thank everyone for, you know, entering the competition.
Yeah. Sam, what is your overall takeaway now of getting to talk to all of these guys? And, as someone who has, you know, tackled your own projects like this and then been able to, you know, carve out a full-time role doing this kind of work in the industry.
I mean, first kudos to Ben and Nick and you people for putting this on. I think it's great to see stuff like this and give people an opportunity to put their skills to the test. I often get questions of where do I start? What do I do to break into this industry? And it's really about putting pen to paper, or I guess fingers to keyboard, but just getting some experience and being able to start to build a portfolio of projects you've worked on, stuff like that. And there are so many different ways to approach best ball analysis and stuff. Like, again, my gears are turning trying to think of like, what are some things to look at next year when we get BBM4 data in, which is, I'm going to need a supercomputer to digest all of the data from that, but super cool. I think a lot of innovative stuff, but also really building on analysis we've seen historically and pushing it a little bit further, again, seeing it about specific strategies that or parts of the current BBM4 landscape with the wide receiver avalanche, stuff like that too, I think is super cool. And again, to Ben's point, I think, again, one way that people could, if they're trying to get into stuff like this, take someone else's idea, try to recreate it maybe in a different way, or come up with a different way to analyze uniqueness or things like that, I think is a great way to put your skills to the test and stuff like that. And again, it would be very difficult to try to boil this down to one winner.
For sure. Nick, any final thoughts here before we go in the lab and try to figure out who wins this first place prize?
Yeah, I think it's funny. Like a guy like Nick, the guy we just heard from, where clearly has a lot of experience with statistical analysis and this type of thing. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if when we do this next year, like someone's like, okay, I invented a quantum computer so I could look at all these these combinations. Cause it's funny, like a lot of intense data work. Again, really impressed with the professionalism And I think one thing that sticks with me is I think there's an opportunity for someone to go through here and like maybe find the connections. Cause I do think even our five finalists we brought on, they kind of worked off of each other, where you could see like ADP value early plus stacking was brought up a little bit. And then especially like some value over replacement, I guess like metrics that improved upon something that a lot of people think about, they all kind of play in concert with one another. So I think, again, reading through these submissions, if you want to get better at best ball and compete, I think some of the sharper drafters are definitely going to be combing through these submissions, and it'll pay off.
That is another thought I had, Nick, as we were going through these, is how many of them either like overlap or dovetail, or like you said, work in concert with each other. I think that was what was really cool with this idea, especially going back to back with Dan and Nick and looking at wide receiver avalanche. Do you capitulate when there's value at this other position? And then having Nick's research showing even more things to consider when you're about to make that decision, I thought was really cool.
Yeah. And like the fact that there weren't a whole lot of contradictions, I thought was interesting, which is good. It kind of, they validate each other. So this is good info, good data work. Definitely, again, comb through it if you want to get better.
For sure. And, you know, we've mentioned it a few times, you know, Sacrilegious mentioned it. I mentioned how Lou Dog, who submitted to this competition, took the course just months before and was able to put together a really solid submission. That's how quickly you can get caught up to speed and, you know, what Fantasy Data Pros does. You know, it's been a great fit. You know, when we talked early on too, I immediately was like, this audience, how smart they are, how invested everyone is in best ball. I knew immediately that this was a great fit, and getting to host this Data Bowl, to see all of these projects that actually reflect the dilemmas and the things I talk about in draft rooms down to like specifically my drafts with Dan's project was super cool. And can't recommend the Fantasy Data Pros course enough. You know, I keep saying it, you can get 25% off with promo code Pete. We've had a lot of you guys sign up, a lot of good feedback. And you know what? I feel like, you know, we haven't talked about this, but I feel like we're definitely going to run this Data Bowl back again next year. It'll be bigger, it'll be better. And you have plenty of time now. Get in the lab, review these submissions, get the Fantasy Data Pros course, and you guys can get up to speed and be competing next year with what Sam just hinted at, a much, much larger data set. It's going to be very fun to have another year of data here. So again, thank you to Ben. Thank you to Nick and Fantasy Data Pros, all of the great submissions, everyone who's watched. And as I mentioned at the top, leave a comment. Let us know which submissions impressed you the most. You know, we haven't talked about how we're going to fully finalize who wins here, but I do think getting your guys's feedback and knowing what resonated with you will also help inform this process. And again, shout out to Sam Hoppen. You can check all of his work over on Fantasy Pros. Any new projects you're working on, Sam, that people should keep an eye out for?
Unfortunately straying away from football for right now and working on some other sport projections like that, but we'll be involved with the Fantasy Pros and Betting Pros podcast throughout the regular seasons. I believe Hopping to Conclusions is coming back for a third season. So we'll have that throughout the week as well.
Awesome. Well, appreciate everyone. I'm going to get this posted here. And yeah, we will be announcing. Ben, do we have a timeline? Because people are going to want to know, when are we going to crown this champion here?
I think end of week, probably. Yep. By Friday. Not sure.
Sounds good. We will keep you posted. You can keep your eyes peeled, you know, on our Twitter accounts. We will make sure we get that out to the public. And yeah, great work all around. Again, thank you guys. Has been a blast hosting and judging and reviewing all these submissions. Good luck out there in the rest of your drafts. We'll see you guys next time.